Hello and welcome to the GSC Grays Land Value Negotiations podcast, where we will explore the basis for valuing development land and the factors that influence land value. We'll consider the actions a landowner can take to quantify the development costs and how that can influence negotiations with a developer and why costs are something which we scrutinise. I'm joined now by Callum Gillespie, a director with GSC Grays, who heads up the planning and development team. With 20 years' experience in the field, Callum regularly works with large housing sites on both their promotion and their disposal. The company is currently working on sites at various stages, and if all are developed, they would yield around 25,000 new homes. Callum is very close to all of these sites and familiar with the issues they each face. Also joining me is Glenn Bland. Glenn is a chartered quantity surveyor with 25 years' experience. He started his career with one of the UK's largest construction companies and then became managing partner at a cost consultancy. For the past 11 years, Glenn has acted as an independent building cost consultant and project manager in the residential sector, working with developers, land agents, promoters, and private clients. Thank you both for joining me. To get us started, Callum, can you tell me what circumstances lead to land value negotiations?
I mean, typically for a landowner, this is going to be where they've either got an option agreement and the developer of the site has got planning, and they've probably served a price notice, or they've got a conditional exchange of contracts, and again, they've reached a similar stage, and you're getting into finalising what that price is likely to be.
And what's the basis for the land value?
Infrequently, you'll have just a plain fixed price, but more often for a conditional sale, you'll have a fixed price less some deductible costs. And if it's under an option agreement, it's typically a percentage of market value.
Is there any preparation you need to do before you assess the land value under an option or a conditional contract?
I mean, to my mind, it's critical that you fully understand the context of the negotiation. And the first place to start with that is looking at what the contract says is the basis for the purchase price. There will probably also be a formal process for the agreement of the price. And I think understanding whether there's a defined timetable that you need to be working to, for instance, and whether there's a dispute resolution mechanism. Most contracts will have one. And I think you need to understand whether that's a process that you would actually want to get into. Now, hopefully the negotiations would all be dealt with on a collaborative basis and you'd reach an amicable settlement without needing recourse to that. But clearly understanding whether it's of appeal to you or not is quite key, especially in the later stages of a negotiation.
So, Glenn, what's the key to properly assessing value?
The way that the house developers assess value is they assess the total development value, how much revenue is obtainable from the site, less the cost to develop the site and less their return on the investment, their margin they're looking to make. And it's within the costs that the land value is mostly affected, because those costs, as inherent with all construction activity, contain risk. And that risk is generally in known costs and unknown costs, normal costs and abnormal costs.
So from a landowner's point of view, there's a decision to be made as to the point at which they fix the price. And the later you get in the process, the more accurate the information that you'll be working with is, and therefore the more accurate the price will be. And I think it doesn't necessarily result in a higher price, but it does result in the right price. And Glenn, we've spoken about the fact that you effectively sell risk, don't you?
Yes, the way the house builders will look at risk, if we look at first their known costs, they'll be very comfortable with the risk in their known costs, their analytical data of the building of the homes themselves, the superstructure particularly. They will happily accept the risk of these costs and they will pretty much fix that in the land development value. It's the known unknowns where the largest impact on the land value will be.
So at whatever point you choose to transact, in order to manage the risk, you need to quantify what you know. How do you go about doing that?
So you start off, as Glenn said, by looking at what the gross development value is of the site. And at this stage, that ought to be relatively straightforward. So you need to look at the number of houses that you've got on the site. You need to look at the mix of the house types, and you need to review each of the house types on the site, you know, which are probably typically 10 to 12, depending on its size. You need to consider the comparable properties in the same market area and assess the value of those, typically broken down onto a pound per square foot basis. And you can then apply your comparable evidence to the site, and that effectively gives you the gross development value. Now, there are elements of the house type, typically their construction, that will have an influence on the value. So Glenn, that's where we tend to get you involved, isn't it? Looking at those construction costs.
Yes, the house builders will look at all of the costs in various different sections, and these sections tend to follow plot costs, the actual cost to build the house itself. And these will be split into substructure costs, superstructure costs, and external works for the actual house, the garden, the drive, the path, the fences. They'll then have site costs, infrastructure costs, roads, paths, sewers, the site-wide costs. And then they will have costs which are the site delivery costs. These series of costs will follow, again, the known and unknown parameters that we've raised earlier. The superstructure costs, they know very, very well. An abundance of analytical information from their portfolio of house types, they'll know these costs very well. There may be development issues or planning issues where we will have a stone facade in lieu of a facing brickwork facade, or a roof slate in lieu of a roof tile. Again, they will know these costs, and they can interchange these facade costs, fundamental costs, very easily, and they will accept all the costs of the superstructure of the house. Very known, happy to manage those risks. Substructures, if the site follows a standard foundation, a concrete strip foundation, say, which is deemed a standard foundation, again, this will be a normal cost. They will happily accept the risk associated with those costs. Any other foundation cost, whether the foundations are larger, deeper, wider, piling, it would be deemed an abnormal cost, and they would look to reduce or allocate or even defer those costs in their assessment of the land value. So this is a first element of an unknown. They don't know what the substrate is. They don't know what they're founding on. Therefore, the foundation cost, the substructure cost, will become an abnormal cost, a cost risk that they are looking to allocate or avoid or defer.
And now, some of the projects where we've worked together, Glenn, we've looked at the standard cost, haven't we, but looked at how we can value engineer that. And I know that I was quite amazed how the price of bricks can change enormously, you know, from a standard brick to something that's fairly exotic.
Yeah, I think the house builders will, where they can, look to stick to a stock brick, because it's a brick they will use on their whole portfolio. They will have very good buying power on those, and they will really manage the cost very well for those bricks. Where a planning condition or value add opportunity through a different brick type or a different facade type, there is a potential that can become an unknown and abnormal, but we would look to seek to do work to define the cost of that brick. The measurable element is a measurable element. The cost of the material may have changed. It will present an impact to the land value, but it is something that can be assessed, and we would have to work on that and assess the impact of that cost. Outside the houses themselves are the site costs, and these tend to be the roads, the sewers, the paths, the street lighting. These will normally be assessed on a site-specific basis, measurable from on a site-specific basis. They will seek to get cost estimates for this works, but it is less known but not fundamentally unknown, because it is measurable and they have cost data, they have analysis, because it's the type of work they do all the time. And the normal works will sit in the normal costs. It's where those works have unknown elements in them, and you know, something we can discuss further is adoptable roads come with certain specifications that inherently give you abnormal costs. And this is another area where the house builder would look to defer or allocate the risk of that abnormal in the infrastructure costs.
So we've gone through and identified the land value and the known costs. So now how would we go about identifying those things that you know you don't know?
I think there are certain knowledge gaps that exist at whatever point you reach this stage, Chris. And I think you need to decide whether you're going to incur that expense yourself as a landowner, or whether you want to treat it on an open book basis. And again, this is, you know, a pre-planning contractual decision that a landowner needs to make. You know, the most costly element to understand is what goes on below ground. And you can go through the process of refining what you know, or as I say, make the decision on whether you deal with that on an open book basis.
When you say open book, can you just clarify what that means?
So this will be where you contractually agree with the buyer that they will be transparent and honest with you, and go through a process, perhaps through competitive tendering. So I think Glenn was talking about having abnormal foundations. You know, that the costs for that will be dictated by the type of foundation that's needed. So Glenn, I mean, you'd have a typical concrete footing, wouldn't you? But there'll be a number of other alternatives that you might see on site.
Various sites have different substructure conditions, and this will inform the type of foundation. And from our point of view, it's moving what is a known unknown to a more of a normal cost. The more investigation we do on the substructure, the structural element of the house, the more we can move essentially an abnormal foundation to a normally costed foundation by determining through investigation what the foundation will need to be for building regulation compliance and HBC compliance. These can become measurable elements proportionate to how much investigation we're prepared to do to bring the unknown foundations into the known foundation remit. Once they're in the known foundations, we can assess the cost of them with more accuracy. Therefore, they move from an abnormal to a normal, less risk inherently attached to them. More costs can be defined within the land value, giving us a better, more accurate land value.
So I guess the pile foundations would be quite a good example of going open book, wouldn't it? Because the house builder wouldn't have the skill to do that or the resource to do that in-house. So they would always go to an external contractor to do the piles. And we could require them to get, you know, three prices based on an agreed specification. And then they disclose all of that to us then, Chris, and that effectively gives you your open book approach. So the costs are all dealt with transparently, and then they're just deducted from the headline price that we'd started with.
Different structural engineers will interpret it in different ways. Fundamentally, it's the NHBC guidance compliance that the house builders need to get will inform the foundations that there are certain bearing levels of a simple strip foundation, a wide strip foundation, an extra depth strip foundation to a pile foundation. But it's that investigation we can do to understand the bearing pressure will allow us to inform what the necessary foundation is. Once we have that structural design information, we can then, as Callum says, we can then manage how we turn that abnormal cost into a more defined cost, whether it be open book tenders with piling contractors is probably one of the easiest procurement routes to fix or get a huge amount of cost certainty on a potentially unknown foundation.
I think this comes back to the point we were making earlier, doesn't it? It's about the fact that you sell risk. So if the house builder doesn't know what that pile foundation design is, but you want to fix the price before you've got the information, then the reality is that you've got to accept that there'll be a reasonable contingency built into that figure to protect the house builder from the risk that that pile cost goes beyond what they might reasonably have expected. And so I think that, I guess, is the essence of open book. I think the thing that I would always say is check that that's actually what happens then on the ground, because you don't want to pay for, you know, 100 plots to be piled when you only find that there are 10 ultimately that have it. So I think that's just me with my cynical hat on.
I mean, that kind of informs the position, Callum, that the amount of investigation and design we're prepared to do is proportional of how much of the cost risk we can manage and allocate. Yeah. Fundamentally, the house builders do not want to accept risk. It's an impact on their commercial development, so they will look to shed this risk wherever. We have to work to the position of giving them sufficient information to either define that risk or give enough information that they are prepared to buy that risk back as part of the land deal. It's fundamentally, it's where we want to sit along the linear line of risk to return.
Yeah, I think this is part of managing landowner expectations as well, I guess, because people see that the grant of planning consent is, you know, the hard yards done at that point. That's actually the relatively easy part of the work. And protecting their value comes in going through and scrutinising these costs. And as you say, taking the view that's right for that site and proportionate to the client's ability to either fund some of that work if they're going to do it themselves, or to continue carrying some uncertainty around the price. But understanding that there's a process that you can go through that deals with that on a transparent basis. And I think foundations, I guess, are quite an obvious one. The one that I think we're seeing more of, I guess, is about capping layers, isn't it, under roads, which can be a massive cost.
It is, again, Callum, it's the fact that the house builder is not prepared, or is generally not prepared, to accept risk, and there is inherent risk in capping layer. In a normal residential development, the roads will be adopted by the local authority following the development. Because of that, the local authority determine a certain specification that has to be met for the construction of the road. In with that is the capping layer, the bearing pressure of the road. You find that the local authority will not determine the level of capping layer until the road is actually being constructed, so during the works. So the level of capping layer, the level of bearing from the road, will always remain unknown until the road is physically built and accepted by the local authority to be their specification. And one of the fundamental costs of this is the capping layer, how much additional engineered fill has to go into the road in order for the road to be accepted for adoption by the local authority. And house builders will always seek to allocate and avoid the risk of the capping layer, because no one can actually tell what that is until it's actually carried out on site. So fundamentally, after the land has been transacted. So the abnormal cost of the capping layer will always remain. It is an absolute definition of a known unknown.
I guess from a landowner's point of view, contamination is probably one of the classic abnormal costs that they would expect to see, whereas capping is one that they wouldn't. A landowner will often know whether a site is contaminated or not because there's been an activity on there previously that they're aware of. That would be an abnormal, but it's sort of probably a known abnormal, isn't it, rather than an unknown unknown. But you know that it exists, but you don't know what the quantity is, similar to a lot of these. I mean, is this something you've come across elsewhere, Glenn? Are there ways in which that can be dealt with?
I think the way we deal with contamination, it kind of goes back to the issue we raised earlier. It's the amount of investigation you do to design your mitigation will be proportional to how the assessment of the abnormal is, if that makes sense. if there's an acknowledgement there is contamination, there therefore needs to be a mitigation strategy for that contamination. And the more a land vendor invests in understanding the mitigation strategy and defining the mitigation strategy, the more that the abnormal can move along the line of abnormal towards normal cost. Now, some landowners of particularly contaminated sites will seek to do the work themselves, will seek to do the full investigation, the full remediation strategy, and actually invest in doing the work themselves to manage the contamination. Therefore, the site becomes an uncontaminated site when it can be sold on, therefore a direct impact on the land value.
And I guess from the landowner's point of view, if they clean up the sites, then from the house builder's perspective, they've dealt with the risk entirely. But what they would need to do is to warrant that they've done the work as they should have done. And then they'll probably need to indemnify the house builder against the scenario where they turn up on site and there's still a pocket of contamination that's been left behind. And they then just need to make sure that they're contractually protected from whoever's, first of all, planned the remediation work and secondly carried it out. I guess, Chris, that's looking at it on an open book basis from the other perspective, because the landowner's having to go open book in terms of how they've dealt with it for the house builder rather than the other way around.
So a lot of that's managing risk, isn't it? The landowner can do a lot of the work themselves, but at their own cost, or they could accept that the house builder's going to take that risk, but wherever possible, going to pass on the cost back to the landowner again.
Yes.
So what's left now would be to try and identify anything which we don't yet know. So the unknown unknowns. Glenn, can you talk me through that?
The unknowns unknowns are generally off-site costs, the infrastructure, utility costs, services, electric, gas, water, telecoms, very sites specific and obviously subject to the supplies coming into the site from third-party companies. Generally, you will have no knowledge of what these costs are, and estimating these costs are very, very difficult because they are subject to so many levels of unknown. The provision at the site, how far the services are from the site, how you're bringing the sites in, that there is no real way of determining these costs in the land value. They will always remain an unknown unknowns and can have very significant impact. The unknowns of the services do need some more investment in the sense of the investigation, contacting the utilities, but there are certain elements of services that we could possibly not know until we'd start developing the site. If other services exist within the site, if other services would exist within the vicinity of the site, which we have to move, lower, divert, these can have significant cost implications on the land values and are inherently unknown unknowns.
I guess this is where, from a landowner's point of view, you know, they need to ensure that contractually they've got an ability to participate in those negotiations, because quite often these things come up relatively late in the day, don't they? Because the utility companies aren't particularly good at coming back with prices. And from a house buyer's point of view, if it's a deductible cost, it's effectively at no cost to them. It's purely at the cost of the landowner. And therefore, they'll just have a tendency to choose the easiest option, even though it might not be the most cost-effective solution, but it might be the swiftest solution. And then from a landowner's point of view, you know, there's a tension there because they possibly want that cost interrogated more fully, given that it's ultimately them that's paying the bill. But if you haven't contractually reserved your right to be involved in those discussions, then quite often there's nothing you can do to particularly influence that.
Yes, they are very difficult to manage the costs in the sense of, as you say, the utility services tend to be slow to respond. They tend to be quite difficult to identify those costs. And furthermore, once you get any costs from a utility, it will be time barred. 90 days will normally what you get. So immediately when you get any cost advice, it will be out of date. So it will always remain an unknown cost. And there needs to be some way to manage that cost during the development, because it will always remain alive unknown until the actual service is installed or diverted or lowered. The costs are always a current cost.
Yeah. One thing that we've been able to do where we've got competition for a site is to look to negotiate a closed list of abnormals with a developer. So the landowner isn't exposed to every single risk, but there is a list of those items, and anything that's not on the list is the developer's cost. But developers are very risk averse, aren't they, as you've said, and they want to pass that cost back to the landowner. So that's really only achievable where you've got a reasonable level of competition for the site.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, all commercial developments are market effective. They have market forces that act upon them. The more competition for a site, there is a difference in the way the house develops will look at risk and manage risk, and they'll all do it slightly differently. The more competition for a site, the more they will have to take the decision to manage risk themselves and not pass it back. It's a commercial transaction, and there'll always be conditions and market forces at play.
Yeah, and I think when you look at what those management strategies are, I mean, I guess from my point of view, I start with managing it contractually, so you never get exposed to the risk in the first place, if you can. I guess the second is to, from a client management point of view, is just to discuss with them what the costs might be of those items that are left. And I guess that's looking at allowances that we've ended up negotiating on similar sites, but that's only ever a benchmark. And the other one is to give them the protection of a minimum price in the contract. So whatever happens with the deductible costs, they're always going to get a guaranteed minimum figure. I know in this part of the world, we come across mine workings on a regular basis, and quite often, you know, a house builder simply won't commit to a minimum price if they're dealing with, say, you know, land that's been open cast in the past, because they simply cannot quantify with any certainty what risk they're taking on. And I guess the other one then is physically managing that, either by avoiding the risk or, as you were saying, Glenn, earlier, you know, investigating it and coming up with a mitigation scheme and then passing that on in some fashion to the buyer.
Yes, I suppose another way of looking at it is, as the land vendor, we are looking to sell that risk, guarantee our return. The house developer are looking to avoid that risk and not buy that risk. And somewhere along that line is the allocation of risk that both parties are prepared to buy and sell, and a commercial transaction that suits those parties. And it's the it's the management of how we allocate and manage that risk along the linear line between selling risk and generating sales value. And from the other side, that is fundamentally the purpose of the commercial settlement.
Thank you both. I think that's been really helpful. I think there's one thing that we all agreed on with this, which is that there's always going to be an inherent risk in any construction project. The management and best allocation of that risk delivers the best land deals, and risk analysis and management is critical in assessing land value. I suppose the key take-homes are that we'd need to get a detailed understanding of the processes involved through the construction. We need to understand the ability to forensically examine the costs, should the landowner wish to do so. They need to dig deeper into the headline values and not just take them all at face value, and use the contract with the developer to their advantage, because there could be various provisions in there that could protect the landowner from the risk that the developer is trying to pass on to them. So I think this has been really informative. Thank you both for your time and your contributions. I'd like to thank you for joining me.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.